This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As the planet continues to warm despite the pandemic, one of America's leading climate scientists is defunded by Trump, slashed from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. We talk with Dr. Ben Santer about proving climate change and the powers of denial. Plus, are you quietly yearning for the big breakdown that will transform society, ushered in by the COVID-19 pandemic? Don't count on it. According to new research, most of what we think we know about these great storms of disease is folk legend. Historian Merle Eisenberg finds the two plagues before this one did not radically reshape society. We talk pandemic myths and popular reactions to mass illness. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is a scientist whose work is cited by thousands of other scientific papers. Since declaring in 1995 that climate change was real and could be proven, Dr. Ben Santer has been hounded by climate cranks and fossil-funded voices. Even so, he continued his important research with a specialty of identifying human fingerprints on big changes from the oceans to snow, rivers, droughts, clouds, seasons, and the atmosphere. Until 2020, Ben Santer's work was funded by the U.S. government's Department of Energy. He worked out of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. On November 7, 2020, Ben published an open letter to Joe Biden in Scientific American. He warned American science was twisted into silence or worse, promoting fantasy instead of fact. From California, Ben Santer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. One small correction. I'm actually in Fort Collins, Colorado, not in California.
Good for you. Love Colorado. So before we get to the damage done, I'd really like to take a little look at your work. What is a human fingerprint on the climate?
Well, let's back up a little bit, back to 1979. In 79, Klaus Hasselmann, who was then the director of the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg in Germany, published a very influential paper in an obscure conference proceedings. And the paper was about climate fingerprinting. Hasselmann's thesis was that if climate scientists looked at complex patterns of climate change, think geographical patterns at the Earth's surface or slices through the ocean or slices through the atmosphere, rather than just looking at one number, say the average temperature of planet Earth's surface, then the use of that pattern information could be very helpful in trying to separate human effects on climate, think a human-caused global warming signal, from natural climate variability, the vagaries of climate that arise from purely natural factors like El Niños and La Niñas, so modes of internal fluctuation of climate, changes in the sun's energy output, again, something purely natural, changes in the amount of volcanic aerosol in the atmosphere. Hasselmann's thesis was looking at patterns can help us to discriminate between a human-caused warming signal and this rich background noise of natural climate variability. And when I was starting my postdoc in 1987 at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Klaus Hasselmann said to me, this would be a nice thing for a young scientist to do, to look at my 1979 paper about fingerprinting and actually try and do this in the real world, to use pattern information to identify a human effect on climate. And that's what I did when I started my postdoc at the Max Planck Institute in 1987.
I think there could be a misunderstanding about your work on the human fingerprint. The media and much of the public expect scientists to say a specific storm or wildfire season was caused by climate change. Can that be done? And is that what you really do?
Let's take the second part of your question first. No, that's not really what I do. Most of my research, almost all of my research, has focused on broad brush changes in climate, So think the warming of the lower atmosphere over the last 40-plus years, the period over which we've measured atmospheric temperature from space. Think the increase in the heat content of the uppermost layers of the ocean, which we've measured using a variety of different measurement systems for the last 50, 60 years. Those are the kind of things that I've looked at, changes in climate over the last 40 to 60 years or so. And my job is to interrogate those observed changes and figure out whether there's a human-caused warming signal in them. Now, recently, particularly after the European summer heat wave in 2003, scientists have been trying to do exactly what you said. They've been trying to look at specific extreme events like that highly unusual European summer heat wave in 2003. It was nearly 2 degrees Celsius warmer in the summertime over much of southern Europe than normal. So a very, very unusual event, severe impacts on human health, thousands of citizens died. And climate scientists wanted to ask, how has human-caused warming changed likelihood of that type of threshold cost? And that's what scientists have looked at since then. They engage in what's called event attribution. They look at how human-caused warming of the atmosphere and surface changes the likelihood of that type of event.
Well, please help me get through a couple of fundamental questions that may help us understand. First, not all extreme weather is connected to climate change. True or false?
I would say true, but I would also say that through the work that I described initially, through the fingerprinting that looks at broad brush human influences on global climate, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that human-caused fossil fuel burning has increased levels of heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That, in turn, has warmed the atmosphere, the oceans, the Earth's surface. It's moistened the atmosphere. And we know that those broad-brush changes in global climate, in temperature and moisture and atmospheric circulation, inevitably affect the statistics of extreme events. So the notion that one could burn fossil fuels and change the climate and have no impact whatsoever on heat waves, on flooding, on other types of extreme event is just not tenable. The challenge, though, is trying to figure out exactly how human-caused changes in global climate manifest on the ground in terms of the frequency, intensity, and duration of extreme events. Our best understanding is that for some classes of extreme events, particularly heat waves, there's pretty clear evidence that as we warm the planet, we make heat waves more intense, we make them longer lasting, and we make them more frequent. The same with severe downpours. By warming the atmosphere, a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. We've observed that increase in atmospheric moisture. And one consequence of that moistening of the atmosphere is that when we get storms, we tend to have heavier downpours. Particularly, we see that in the heaviest downpours. So those types of extreme events, heat waves, extreme flooding, we do see some pretty clear relationship between human activity, warming and moistening of the atmosphere, and changes in extreme events. For other classes of extreme events, the jury is still out. So think hurricanes. It's pretty clear that human-caused warming of tropical oceans where hurricanes form is leading to an increase in the intensity of hurricanes. Whether, however, the frequency of hurricanes is also changing and how it might change in the future, the jury is still out on that.
Well, that leads to me to a bigger question. Has human-induced climate change introduced new processes in Earth's system, or can it only amplify existing things?
The message from paleoclimate is that there are tipping points in Earth's climate system. And when we exceed those tipping points, we can get rapid changes in the climate system that look dissimilar to anything that we've actually lived through over the last several centuries of Earth's climate history. One phenomenon that has received a lot of attention is a change in the so-called conveyor belt circulation of the Atlantic, the circulation that's responsible for bringing warm, more saline water from the tropics to the North Atlantic and keeping much of Europe at warmer temperatures than it would otherwise be without that ocean circulation. And we know from paleoclimate that when you start changing the temperature and salinity of the North Atlantic, one of the regions that drives this ocean conveyor belt circulation in the North Atlantic, you can get changes in the circulation that could have serious consequences for European temperature. Again, we see that in paleoclimate records. And the concern is that that's exactly what we're doing. By warming the atmosphere and the surface, we're melting ice sheets. We've observed melting of the Greenland ice sheet. We're changing the influx of fresh water into the North Atlantic. We're changing the temperature structure of the North Atlantic. And all of those things could lead to some change in the Atlantic ocean circulation that would have serious consequences for regional climate. Again, the lesson from the past is those sorts of events exist. We know they're there, and we know that we're changing the conditions that could favor the exceedance of such tipping points. Another tipping point that has received a lot of attention is permafrost and the thawing of Arctic permafrost, the release of methane from thawing Arctic permafrost. There are these classic YouTube videos of people actually lighting, outgassing methane from thawing permafrost. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, and we know from the past, from paleoclimate, and again from the present, from these measurements of outgassing methane, that thawing permafrost and rapidly thawing permafrost is probably not a good idea and will likely constitute a positive amplifying feedback effect that will release more methane into the atmosphere and exacerbate warming. Another concern is the destabilization of these so-called methane clathrates that are on the floors of continental shelves at high latitudes. By warming the oceans, we could be in a situation where we destabilize these semi-solid compounds and from the ocean side then release methane to the atmosphere. So the two things I've mentioned, thawing of the permafrost and changing of the Atlantic conveyor belt circulation, would not just be amplification of the kinds of changes we've seen over the last century. They could well significantly alter polar climate and could significantly alter ocean circulation.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Let's look at a couple of your papers. In 2018, you led the paper Human Influence on the Seasonal Cycle of Tropospheric Temperature. In layperson's terms, what did your team uncover about changes to the seasons when we alter the atmosphere?
Well, most of the fingerprint work that I've talked about looks at broad brush changes in annual climate or in decade to decade climate. Not many formal fingerprint papers look at seasonal aspects of climate change and try to consider the following question. Can we formally identify a human fingerprint on the march of the seasons themselves? And that was the question we posed. We looked at satellite measurements of the temperature of the lowermost layer of the Earth's atmosphere, the troposphere, and we had looked at tropospheric temperature in many of our previous papers, but not at changes in seasonality. And what we wanted to know was essentially whether the difference between winter and summer temperature was changing in the satellite temperature measurements and in climate model simulations with human-caused greenhouse gas increases. And it was. What we found was kind of curious. In mid-latitudes of the northern hemisphere, so think between about 40 north and 60 north, we found that the size of the seasonal cycle was increasing, that it was warming, the temperature of the troposphere was warming in every month, but it was warming more in summertime than in wintertime, and that was actually leading to an increase in the size of the seasonal temperature difference between winter and summer. We tried to probe the causes of that increase in the seasonal cycle, and it seemed to be related to two things. One was the drying of soils in summertime. With increased greenhouse gases, with warming, you tend in summertime to dry out the soils, again, which has been observed in continental mid-latitude interiors. And with that drying of soils, you have less evaporative cooling in the summertime, so less of a natural cooling effect, particularly in continental interiors. And that means that summertime temperature increases can be substantial. This effect was really studied over 50 years ago by a guy called Suki Manabe and his colleagues at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton. And again, we see this phenomenon, this soil drying and concomitant increase in summertime temperatures in observations and in almost all climate model simulations. And this was part of the reason this summertime soil drying that we saw this curious fingerprint in the seasonal cycle of troposphere temperature. But another part of it was the expansion of the tropics. One phenomenon that has been widely reported on in the last decade or so is that the tropics are expanding with global warming. And that expansion of the tropics also seems to factor into this change in the size of the seasonal temperature cycle.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Ben Santer. All through your work, Ben, we find two competing forces, the warming brought about by increased gases in the atmosphere and a simultaneous cooling as solar energy is blocked by pollution or volcanic dust. How do these two forces compare?
Well, the warming signal caused by fossil fuel burning and increases in atmospheric concentrations of heat-trapping greenhouse gases is truly global. The second effect that you mentioned, the scattering of incoming sunlight by particulate pollution, think these sulfate aerosol particles, a byproduct of combustion processes, that is not global. That is more regional and in areas where one has heavy local pollution, heavy atmospheric burdens of these sulfate aerosol particles, you can have cooling of the surface. You can reduce the amount of sunlight that reaches the Earth's surface and cause localized and even regional cooling, again, in areas where there are heavy local pollution burdens. This was a really interesting development in climate science. In the 1960s and 70s, most of the interest in the climate science community was on understanding the global scale warming signal arising from fossil fuel burning and increases in CO2 and other greenhouse gases. But in the late 70s and early 80s, there was this dawning recognition in the climate science community that human influences on climate were more complex than just greenhouse gases. And that indeed, scientists needed to understand and try and model particulate pollution. And that's exactly what happened. And in the 80s and 90s, then, climate modelers performed simulations where they not only increased greenhouse gases according to our best understanding of the actual changes in atmospheric levels of greenhouse gases, but they also developed more complex climate models with atmospheric chemistry in them. And those atmospheric chemistry models were driven by estimated changes in the emissions of things like sulfur dioxide. And those models then calculated atmospheric burdens of particulate pollution and moved that pollution around with the meteorology of the model, with the winds, with the atmospheric circulation. And I would argue that that was a real aha moment when scientists began to go beyond just looking at greenhouse gas effects alone and recognize that regionally particulate pollution could and would be important to represent in climate models, to try and understand, and to try and identify the signals of that particulate pollution in observed climate records.
Ben Santer, you've been ranked as one of the most cited climate scientists on global warming. Almost a decade ago, you were elected a fellow of the American Geophysical Union. You're a member of the National Academy of Sciences. And yet, in September 2020, you lost your position as a key research scientist at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. What happened?
Well, I think it's fair to say, as I tried to say in the open letter that you mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, that the last 4 years have been tough if you're a federally funded climate scientist in the United States. The Trump administration has not been a big fan of climate change science. And my work and the work of my colleagues that tries to look at causation, that tries to say something in an informed, responsible way about the relative sizes of human and natural effects on climate, that research has been anathema to the current administration. Likewise, much of the thrust of our research has been to look at satellite temperature measurements, like the measurements we just discussed of tropospheric temperature change, that were very influential in identifying a human fingerprint on the seasonal cycle of atmospheric temperature. So it's been a tough road to plow, and the funding for climate change detection and attribution research at Lawrence Livermore National Lab was recently cut by the Department of Energy. I would say that those cuts occurred despite a stellar record of scientific performance in climate fingerprinting over the last 4 year period. And despite a continuing need to reliably quantify the size of the human effect on global climate, and despite extraordinary congressional interest in the satellite measurements of atmospheric temperature change. So we were doing the wrong type of research at the wrong time. And in my opinion, it was that confluence of an administration that didn't like work on causation, didn't like work that added to the evidence of a serious human effect on climate. That confluence of doing the wrong work at the wrong time, in my opinion, led to this funding cut. I decided that it was time for me to leave the Department of Energy. And after the decision to cut the funding for climate fingerprinting work, I transitioned to a different source of funding. So I no longer receive funding from the U.S. Department of Energy, Office of Biological and Environmental Research, and instead I will be funded for fiscal year 2021, so until September 2021, by Lawrence Livermore National Lab to complete ongoing research projects and to try and mentor younger colleagues.
But in your letter in Scientific American, you went much further than pleading your own case. You talked about twisted science, really, in the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Energy. We could go on. What sort of fears or reactions were you seeing in the climate science community?
Well, as has been widely reported in the New York Times and elsewhere, the challenges I described were pervasive in other agencies. Scientists were fired. proposals for funding of federal climate science were asked to remove the words climate change. There was an attempt to control language. Protections on clean air and clean water were under a full court press by the current administration. It has been the case, too, that scientific advisory boards, like at the EPA, have been gutted, I would say, and have seen the appointment of folks who are just unqualified, who do not have the requisite scientific expertise in order to serve in an advisory capacity. Websites have been changed. Scientific information has been removed from websites that would help the public understand what agencies do in terms of their climate research, what they have learned, and why that understanding should matter to the general public. All of this, when you take a step back and look at it, is extremely concerning if you've spent your entire career trying to advance understanding of the reality and seriousness of human effects on climate. It really does seem like a concerted strategy to suppress the science, to go after scientists who have the temerity to raise their voices and call out this anti-science agenda of the Trump administration. And in my opinion, it needs to stop, and it needs to stop now. And the public needs to be able to understand that when, say, a hurricane forecast is made, as it was for Hurricane Dorian, that forecast is accurate. That forecast is not based on some gut feeling of the President of the United States. That forecast is based on the best available scientific information. The public needs to be able to trust that the scientific advice rendered by federal agencies is the best available advice, untainted by political considerations. We need to get back there again. And in addition, the folks who work at these agencies need to have a restored trust in the agencies themselves, that the work that they are doing will not be censored, will not be viewed through some political lens, but that they will be able to be guided by one prime directive: get the science right. That's the directive that my colleagues and I have followed for the nearly 30 years I've been at Lawrence Livermore National Lab: get the science right. And I'm hoping that that will be the prime directive under the Biden-Harris administration.
Well, as we sort of run out of time here, I just do want to toss in one quote from the famous German scientist Max Planck. He said, "A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it." And I'm seeing a large wave of young climate scientists, including now in universities, I'm told, a majority of women. And that's my hope to get out of this pit of denial. Where do you find your hope for science during the coming decades, Ben Santer?
Well, similarly, when I look at students, when I interact with students, when I interact with young scientists, I see this passion for understanding the strange, beautiful, and complex Earth system, the climate system, and for devoting their lives, their scientific careers, to something that really matters: understanding that system, understanding human influence on it, understanding the climatic shape of things to come for the 21st century and beyond. Despite all of the really difficult things we've witnessed here in the United States, the clear anti-science agenda of the Trump administration, there still is that passion on the part of the next generation of climate scientists and students to make a difference in the world, to work on things that really matter. That gives me justifiable hope for the future. The new administration that already is sending signals, we care about science, and we are going to have people in positions in science agencies who are knowledgeable, who are experts, who have spent their lives trying to understand complex issues and trying to speak science to power. That makes me optimistic about the future. And quite frankly, the public understanding of the reality and seriousness of climate change also makes me optimistic. Look, Over my career, I've witnessed these twin signals, a human-caused warming signal emerging from the background noise of natural climate variability, but also a signal in public understanding. We've moved from the cautious balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate from the IPCC back in 1995 to humans are active agents of change in the climate system. We see human fingerprints everywhere we look in the climate system. And that scientific signal in understanding has also led to a signal in media reporting. We no longer have, not even in the United States, this false balance where scientist A says, yeah, it's real, and scientist B says, no, human-caused climate change isn't happening. It's much more difficult being a denier and receiving any kind of oxygen nowadays. Sure, there are still some out there, but the public understands, particularly after some of the extreme events we've witnessed in the last decade, that climate change is affecting their lives, their livelihoods. We're seeing these discussions in the United States about migration away from California, away from wildfire risk, away from New Orleans and Houston and hurricane risk and communities affected by sea level rise. Think Miami. These discussions are already happening around the country and, of course, around the world. How do I keep my family from harm under a changing climate? So there are opportunities there for respectful discourse on the reality and seriousness and solutions to climate change. That makes me optimistic, too.
Dr. Ben Sander, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, Alex. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Are you quietly yearning for the big breakdown that will transform society, ushered in by the COVID-19 pandemic? Don't count on it. According to new research, most of what we think we know about these great storms of disease could be folk legend. Merle Eisenberg is a postdoctoral fellow at the National Socio-Environmental Synthesis Center at the University of Maryland. He publishes in top journals. One of Dr. Eisenberg's specialties is the so-called Justinian Plague that struck the late Roman Empire around the year 541. Merle also works on how societies act in pandemics. That could be useful. And you can learn a lot from his podcast, Infectious Historians, with Hebrew University scholar Lee Mordecai. From New York, Merle Eisenberg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, first we have to clear up one thing. The COVID-19 virus is not the same as the plague, right?
No, it's far different from it. The plague, as we think about it, which is, you know, we use it as a kind of a catch-all term now for many things that happen to us, disease or not disease-wise. But the plague, as we think about it, is a bacterium called Yersinia pestis, first located under a microscope in 1894, but it's been confirmed through various studies that this is something that's existed for thousands of years. So at a very basic level, the plague is bacterium, and COVID-19, as probably many of your listeners know, is a virus.
And it seems common knowledge that a plague caused the final downfall of the Roman Empire. A lot of people think that. Is it supported by the facts? And what sort of facts can we collect at this late date about an illness that happened 1,500 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? I mean, the old story is the farther back we go in history, the more we're willing to kind of say that a pandemic or really great events cause change in history. So, you know, when you go back to the late Roman Empire, you know that the Roman Empire goes away, at least in what's now Western Europe. And you also know eventually the Eastern Roman Empire, which is what's now in the Balkans and Turkey and the Middle East, eventually will be taken over and lose much of its territory to the early Islamic conquest. And so we look to big things that happen to explain these great changes in history. But if you actually look into the evidence, there's not much connection between the outbreak of plague and any of these other great momentous changes in history.
Do we have evidence of mass deaths or an economic collapse during the plague of the mid-500s?
Yeah, so we do have accounts from literature that's written at the time, historical accounts, and they give us evidence that there was a breakout of plague that happens in the year 541 in Egypt that gradually spreads around the rest of the Mediterranean world. But what we don't have from those written sources, or really any other sources, are good concrete evidence of numbers, right? So you'll have numbers in some of these literary accounts that are clearly exaggerated, right? They'll say something like 10,000 people died a day in one city, which if you just do some back-of-the-envelope math, you basically the whole city dies within a matter of weeks. So what you probably have is actually something not dissimilar from what many people are going through today, which is certain places had more severe outbreaks and certain places did not. So that's in terms of the death. In terms of economic consequences, we actually really don't have much evidence whatsoever. The only evidence we have is a handful of laws that are passed that seem to say that maybe working conditions changed a bit. And you also have some evidence from coinage that changes a little bit. But really, there's not much evidence. What we have evidence for is, after the end of the Roman world, that the sophisticated tax apparatus that's happening at the time tends to disappear slowly over the course of the 6th century and the 7th century, and in fact probably starts earlier. So people will often say, aha, you know, I know the economics change and thus plague might have something to do with it. But we have no direct causal link between.
We've been talking about the plague in ancient times. Is that same plague bacterium still hovering in the United States, and is there a chance of it becoming another mass killer?
Yeah. So what happens much later on in the 540s that we've just been talking about is that in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century, the plague spreads really throughout the entire world. It's on every continent now other than Antarctica. So famously in the United States in particular, it reaches San Francisco in the year 1900, and it spreads through animals from there. So plague generally lives in small rodents. There's about 200 or 300 species that it can be in, and rats are the most famous. But right now you can find them really across the entire western United States. I would imagine perhaps up into Canada as well in terms of where it kind of lives in these animals. And every once in a while, what will happen, generally hunters is usually the case. People will go shoot or hang out with small rodents, and sometimes we'll actually get the plague from the fleas that are living on rodents. We'll jump from the rodents to the humans and bite them.
So during the Middle Ages, North Europeans learned to live with the plague over several hundred years. I mean, that's why Newton had to leave London when he discovered gravity. I expect we will be struggling with this coronavirus at least until the end of 2021, and it may pop up from time to time due to unvaccinated people at home or abroad. Is there a mirror in time that we can learn from in these earlier pandemics of how people adjust to living with the disease?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, right? That's what we all kind of want to know. You know, in a sense, people did get used to what to do and how to react to plague outbreaks, right? As you just said, Newton famously fled cities, and that's what happened during the 6th and 7th century as well, right? We have accounts where people would get wind of the plague, and they would kind of run up into the foothills of the nearby mountain ranges and kind of avoid their low-lying towns that seem to get affected more by plague. And so there is a sense that we all know what to do. I mean, if you think back to how you reacted to COVID probably in March, right, everyone was frantically wiping down all the groceries that came into their house because the early reports said it was surface contact. You know, within a few months, that proved to not be the case. And so I think people are pretty resilient and adaptable to these things. And, you know, there's no difference from people in a pre-modern setting and a modern setting in that way.
In the authoritative proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in December 2019, you and Lee Mordecai and others suggested the Justinianic plague might be just an inconsequential pandemic. Why would you say that?
Well, the major narrative that exists of it, as you pointed out earlier, is that it causes massive societal change
at all levels of human life, whether it be economics, culture, political, taxes, all these type of things. And what we looked for were data sets to see if that was the case. And what we couldn't find were really any changes that were happening in the 6th century, as I said. We couldn't find any really good economic indicators. We couldn't find any good cultural indicators. We couldn't find any ways in which life had changed. One way we did this was through pollen analysis, for example, where we went through and we kind of figured out, were there fewer people farming the land, right? Because if a large number of people had died, you would expect fewer people working the land. And that didn't seem to be the case at all, right? So people are just kind of going on how they did before. And so that's why we framed it in that way. We just don't have evidence of this pandemic really changing how people live their lives at all.
But strange things do happen after a pandemic arrives. I was talking about the flagellants, the people who whipped themselves that went from town to town during medieval times. What can history teach us about social reactions when a pandemic strikes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something we've seen today, you know, during COVID especially, following the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests. I think social reactions are relatively common. And that's something that certainly there are historical parallels to that. But there's also historical parallels where things don't actually change all that much either, right? I mean, the famous example here that people like to use is the 1918 influenza pandemic, right, where life on one side or the other actually wasn't that significantly different. So it really depends upon how people react at any given time. And I think that's what will be interesting to see play out during COVID is what is the ultimate outcome in the next 6 or 12 months for how people react to this in various ways. I can tell you in some ways, right, we're already seeing movies, for example, where people are filming COVID movies. And so people are obviously already building that into their cultural repertoire, as it were.
There's also a widespread assumption that climate change enabled the early plague, called after the Roman Emperor Justinian. How did those arguments develop?
Yeah, this is a real fascinating question that we were really curious about because everyone links climate and the outbreak of plague. And what we realized was people had a general paradigm, a model they wanted to follow for much of the 20th century. So I mentioned earlier this globalization of the plague that happens in the 1890s and the early 20th century. And while it spreads and, you know, hits San Francisco, the number of deaths is actually quite low, right? So your listeners shouldn't actually be that fearful of the ground squirrels, for example, I mentioned earlier. You had about 300 deaths in San Francisco over about 40 years, right? So in the grand scheme of things, not a significant death toll. But in other places, such as India, for example, their death toll was about 10 to 12 million people. So it was significant over the course of the same four decades or so. So you see a real discrepancy in the number of people who died. And so the natural question, right, everyone wants to know is why? And so what people came up with as various explanations was that the climate must somehow be different, right? So that the climate allows plague, which lives generally in the guts of fleas, which then hang out on these various animals. And so this allowed the plague to just spread more easily so that it was these particular unique hot and humid temperatures that allowed the plague to spread in India better than, for example, San Francisco, right? San Francisco famously doesn't really have even a nice summer. So that's what people suggested for about a century, right? No one really had proof of this. There was no data from this. But this is just what people said, right? So that past plagues were caused by climate, especially warm and humid climate. But a curious thing happens about 10 years ago, first in 2011, and then in a later study about 5 years later, points out that actually there seems to be a massive series of volcanic eruptions that happen around the Earth in the year 536. And this has caused what's called the late antique Little Ice Age, right? So if the Earth gets much colder, we're talking 2 to 3 degrees here for the next few decades, and it carries on, lingers on for quite a while thereafter. And so now what you have is people say, aha, it gets colder, and that must be the reason why plague broke out. So you can find, if your listeners are curious, you can Google the year 536, why it's the worst year to be alive. And what people will point out in this is that there's this volcanic eruption, everything gets colder, and all of a sudden the plague breaks out. The problem with all of these studies, ultimately, is that there's actually no scientific proof over what the connection is between climate and plague outbreaks.
It would be weirdly comforting to find at least one horrible social ill that is not part of climate change. Are you saying climate change is not a factor in pandemics?
I'm saying it very much is, but the question is, what are the unique mechanisms at a localized level that cause what is called the spillover effect, right? So, you know, why COVID struck in late 2019 in China and how that spilled over into human populations is something that has to be investigated, right? As a broader notion, does the warming Earth mean that people are interacting with more unique diseases? Yes, absolutely. Just as perhaps in, you know, the early 540s CE, there's something having to do with cold temperature and the bacterium itself of Yersinia pestis that may create the conditions. That's absolutely plausible. The question is, how does that actually work? And just saying climate does it doesn't actually allow us to get at solutions at all.
It's very strange that humans, even smart ones like some historians, seem to yearn for catastrophe or large-scale transformation, and then we retrofit our ideas back onto history. And that's something that I think your work really brings out very well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very cool story, right? I mean, how does the Roman Empire fall, right? This is one of these great questions in history that everyone wants to answer, right? There's a whole bunch of these. But that's certainly in the time period I work on the question. And so if you know the outcome of that, you try to fit in various points of data to make that work. And so one thing that's often proposed, you know, obviously given what life is like for all of us today, is now climate change and disease.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is historian Dr. Merle Eisenberg. We are discussing the impacts of mass illness and death on society and civilizations. So, Merle, another truth we inherit was the great leveling in medieval Europe when the Black Death took out swathes of the social fabric from lords to serfs. Some suggest the middle class began because of that plague. What do you think?
There's a few problems with that analysis. On just a purely base level, that idea has been deployed, at least early on in COVID. You know, I was tracking this quite closely. You know, people were suggesting that maybe COVID likewise would lead to economic leveling, right? That we would have a reduction in inequality. And I think we can all see that that's actually been the opposite of the case, right? The inverse of anything has happened, right? Jeff Bezos is even richer than he started during this pandemic. But what that comes out of is a notion from the Black Death model in which it looks like, you know, a large percentage of the population died, it's called 50%, and for the subsequent decade or so, you had a slight rearrangement of labor relations, right, so that people did better or poor people did better in the short term. The problem with that is the only case we know of from all of history where that seems to be the case, this one or two decades after the Black Death in Europe. Right. Every other time the plague strikes, because it returns for several centuries in Europe up through the early 18th century, famously in Marseille, and kills 20, 30, 40% of the population in various regions or various cities, it doesn't actually change the economic inequality whatsoever. Right. In fact, it does nothing whatsoever. So that when we think of that leveling idea, it's literally for the one or two decades after the Black Death in which half the population is dead, and it doesn't work for any other pandemic in all of human history, as far as I'm aware.
The French author Michel Foucault pointed to continuing plague attacks in the Middle Ages as the cause of rising civil authority over our lives in order to control the disease. How do you assess his theories?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, again, another attractive narrative, which probably has something to do with what's happening. But a lot of those ideas of, say, public health and modern sanitary regimes actually start much before the Black Death. This has been some good work done by colleagues, which points out that many of these things we point out and say the Black Death caused it were actually underway by states in the decades and centuries before the Black Death. And that, in fact, that doesn't actually change public health regimes. It might catalyze some final things, but that's really all it does.
But I deeply respect Richard Horton. He's the longtime editor-in-chief of The Lancet, and that's one of the world's top medical journals. In an article published October 31st, 2020, Horton worried about mixing medicine with politics, and he cited Foucault's warning that legitimate public health could lead to authoritarian government. But does history support that?
To an extent, yes. But the question is, when is politics never involved in public health? And I would say it's always involved in public health. And so the choices that people are making are inherently political, right? Whatever they might be. And so is there a greater apparatus now for surveillance of people? Absolutely. And that's something that's certainly going to come or has come and is in the process of happening during COVID. In terms of historical accounts, there's no ability of the state to really do anything in a medieval context aside from collect taxes and basically control an army. And so in that context, it's a very, very different way in which society functioned than it does in a 20th century, very surveillance state one.
Horton also examines the links between social inequality and deaths in a pandemic. In fact, he said the COVID-19 outbreak is not a pandemic, but a syndemic, meaning a combination of conditions. And so that demands we look at health disparity, poverty, and structural violence as players in our current coronavirus tragedy. Do you think that's true of the past, and what do you think about it now?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true 100% now. This is why a number of people I work with have made a number of points that really we need to bring in social scientists, anthropologists, sociologists, historians, and others to really be on board with much of the work that's being done when it comes to COVID, right? Because many of these inequalities that are being raised that we're seeing happen are things that historians have long pointed to, right, during especially, let's say, 20th century pandemics and other outbreaks of disease. And so that's something that I would certainly support and very much push. And it's also something historically we do see. We see, you know, in outbreaks of plague in the 540s that the first people who are struck by these things are the poor. They're the ones who tend to die first, for example, which is very much the case during COVID. But the difference in a pre-modern world and a modern world is the ability of people, you know, to separate themselves from others is much stronger now, right? So, you know, the number of articles that I read early on in the pandemic of, say, you know, rich people fleeing New York City or rich people fleeing Paris or London or take your, you know, your pick of places is just a much greater ability to leave and to really separate the rich from the poor and separate people by race, by gender, ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Merle, we have not discussed the relationships, if any, between religions rising or falling in concert with pandemics. We had Islam appearing fairly shortly after Justinian's plague, and we have some intimations that Roman Catholicism weakened after the Black Death. What links do you think are worthy of study, and which are myths that kind of dead end when the facts come in?
So, I mean, one thing we have to think about, and this is one thing that we stress in our work, is we have to stop assuming that pandemics do things or change things just because they're diseases, right? I mean, it's human beings who shape what the pandemics, the viruses, the bacteria, what they do. And so that's the most important thing to think with, right? So that it's not necessarily that cultural religious changes have to happen. It's how people react to them that allows those changes to take place. So again, the example you use of, say, Islam is a great one, right? I mean, you see the rise of Islam about 90 years or so after the plague breaks out. And so people naturally say, well, is there a relationship? Well, the question I would have for you and for your listeners is, if something happens in 90 years from now, right, so this would be, doing some math, 2110, how much was that tied to COVID? Or how much is it not? Right. I think many of us would say perhaps some shapes of how things work, but many things don't. Right. What's happening now during COVID is not necessarily related to something that started, say, for example, in the 1930s either. And so we have to be very careful drawing these big, very simple explanations from pandemics of the past.
But once they're accepted, big myths, the kind of things we've been talking about, they're hard to kill. Do you think coming historians will make the same mistakes when characterizing the pandemic of 2019, or is your work starting to break through those preconceptions?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I would love to say that everyone's reading my work and everyone believes me, but I'm not that naive. What I think takes hold in the general thinking is a really powerful story and really powerful images. And one way to demystify that is to offer other competing stories, right? To both provide new narratives, new data, new facts that really reflect on what's happening, but also to use that to tell new powerful stories. And so that's something we're keenly aware of. One thing, you know, people like to blame the plague on is rats, for example, right? And if you look up images of plague, you often get things of rats, but you don't actually need rats, famously, right? You could have about, as I said, 200 or 300 other type of animals. And so in some ways, we've internalized these stories, and the question is how to build new stories moving forward. And one way to an extent is to start, obviously, in some ways through changing how things are, how we educate people, how we think about these things, right? I'm always reminded in the United States, right, we take the advanced placement European history exam, which is what a lot of students will take. Well, European history starts in the year 1400, right? That skips out the entire Middle Ages, skips out all of classical antiquity. And so by doing that, we've told a certain narrative of our own past of how we want to consider the world.
Yeah, at first when I read your work, I thought, well, actually, we can't learn anything from history because a lot of it was a myth. But as I dove into it further, I realized, no, some things are true and some things are not.
Yeah. I mean, the other things is, you know, we want lessons that are easily applicable, but it's really tough. You know, even say going back to the 1918 influenza pandemic, because just how people thought and how they lived was so different than today. And it's not as if we learn lessons. I was just looking at the data on the various waves from the 1918 influenza pandemic, and you want to be really depressed, go look at that, because it's just replicating what we're all living through. I mean, the other thing is that we want to use the pandemics of the past as well to provide hope, right? I mean, that's the thing. What's going to happen afterwards, and is there going to be something better coming? And in a sense, I would encourage that thinking, but hope only takes you as far as you want to mobilize for doing something better, right? We're not going to get another renaissance or less social inequality because we all want there to be. You have to actually work at it and look at the structures that allowed this to be such a terrible pandemic, especially in the United States compared to Canada or other places. And you have to use that information to reshape how the structures of your society work.
Has COVID-19 changed your direction as a historian, Merle?
So I've started writing about pandemics before this, right? I mean, this work has obviously appeared before and now during COVID. But by original training, it was not my main project. And so in some ways, it very much has, because this is obviously going to become a topic that people are more and more interested in. And so my interest in this is, in a sense, as an ancient and medieval historian, I'm trying to figure out why we think about the past as we do in the present, and how we use those stories or don't use those stories moving forward, right? So the other great story we like to tell is that after the Black Death, we had a nice renaissance and everyone really did better. But this is obviously a problematic notion as well. And the other thing we've done with my colleague Lee is we started a podcast, as you mentioned at the beginning, called The Infectious Historians, where we bring on various historians in different fields to talk about epidemics, diseases, pandemics of the past, as well as medicine and a whole bunch of other topics.
Where can people find that podcast?
Through any podcasting service you listen to, Spotify, iTunes. You can just go to our website, which is infectioushistorians.com, where we give you as well some more reading if you're curious about various topics that we've touched upon, as well as information on all our guests that we've brought on.
We've been speaking with Dr. Merle Eisenberg, and you can follow some links up on that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Merle, thank you for exploring time with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Please pass this program on to your friends. Get it free at ecoshock.org. And join me again next week. Next week, our feature guest will be one of the most famous climate scientists, Dr. Michael Mann. His new book covers the developing climate emergency, but without a serving of doom. Stay tuned as we roll out the awful truth on the longest-serving green radio program on Earth, Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.